what are some of the things that you're going to be looking for as the legislature gets back into session?
There's a lot. I mean, one is Cooper willing to work with the Republican supermajority, and is the Republican supermajority willing to work with Cooper? And I think that's the real big question, right? So right now, the Republicans have the big stick in Raleigh, and even if they pass something that the governor doesn't like, he can then veto that, and they can override that veto. So are they willing to try to work with him, or do they just push through the agenda that they want to push through?
And what kind of power does Cooper have? You know, they've taken some away, but the Asheville Citizen-Times ran a story the other day that's saying he's not entirely powerless, you know, as governor.
Right. He's certainly not powerless, but traditionally North Carolina has a fairly weak governor. Right? So every state sort of varies in how much power their governors have, and ours tends to be towards the lower end of that list, and then he's been stripped of even more power. So a lot of his real power comes informally. It comes from the fact that if he gives a speech, we listen to it, and we cover it, and we talk about it, that he starts the budget process. So symbolically, that can be very important. But his formal constitutional power is less than a lot of other governors around the country.
Now, I was just talking to Senator Terry Van Dyne, and she was mentioning the loss of Tom Apodaca, of course, being a big loss to Western North Carolina, whether you agree with him or not. But as far as the leadership roles and things like that, is Western North Carolina well represented?
You know, I think Western North Carolina is well represented, but the big question is how does the region coalesce without a figure like Tom Apodaca? So whether you like Tom Apodaca a lot and support his policies or oppose his policies, I think we'd all agree that he was the definition of a powerful figure. He was somebody to be reckoned with both in Raleigh and back at home. And so he tended to organize a lot of the Western North Carolina coalition and, frankly, the entire Senate. And having him out of formal office, I think a lot of us are curious to see who fills that power vacuum.
Do you think that might be Chuck McGrady on the other side of the aisle as far as the House?
Yeah, I think it's very possible. McGrady seems like he has come out as sort of a key broker who has not been perhaps as ideologically vocal as some folks on his party. And so I think, yeah, there's a sense that McGrady could try to fill some of that void for the West. He could become kind of an informal spokesperson for the West in some of the same ways that Apodaca was in the Senate for so many years.
What does that sort of translate to, you know, when you have someone who's in power and for Western North Carolina, you know, because we're kind of thought of as the forgotten part of the state at times?
Yeah, I think so. And we are thought of as a forgotten part of the state. At the same time, we've had some powerful legislators in the past. Clearly, Liston Ramsey ruled North Carolina politics for a very long time. Apodaca had a lot of power. And so I think when you've got a powerful person from the West, one, it reminds folks in Raleigh that we are still part of the state, even though we may be 5 hours away. But at the same time, that our issues may be distinct from those issues that are experienced certainly in the cities of the middle part of the state, but even in the smaller towns of eastern North Carolina. Western North Carolina has unique policy positions just by virtue of geography, if nothing else.
What about some of the specific things? You know, Cooper's brought up Medicaid expansion. He's you know, brought up HB2, of course. They try to broker that deal. What do you think comes up before the legislature?
Sure. I mean, I think this Medicaid expansion issue is the first real test of both sides, right? So I think the lines are pretty clearly drawn, and Cooper has said he wants Medicaid expansion, and he says he has the power, and the legislature has said they don't want it, and he does not have the power. And so I think this one is going to be heard in the courts, and that's going to be the first sign, I think, of what this legislative session looks like and how divisive it can be.
And is it unclear who does have the power? I mean, it seems like state law is pretty set, but then there's, of course, the federal law.
I think both sides are making reasonable arguments. It seems like the legislature is more likely to win this, but there's a reason that these things go to the courts, right? And the court is going to hear this, and it could go in either direction. Obviously, we have a court that leans a little left now. So I think this one really could go either way, and it is certainly the most important policy position that's going to face North Carolina government in the next couple of months.
I see. Okay. And what else are we looking at?
Obviously, the redistricting cases is going to be huge, right? So again, right now we've got the courts sort of in to make policy decisions for the state. So if things stay the way they're set now, then in March we need to have new district lines for at least 28 of our districts across the state. Those will likely touch other districts near them. So we could see a complete or at least a near complete redrawing of the map leading into 2017 elections. And so that is the other sort of key issue that's going to be facing the legislature and facing the courts.
And it would fall on the legislature to draw their own maps again if they were ordered to do so.
That's exactly right. So as it stands right now, it is up to the legislature to draw new lines by this March deadline. And what the court has said is, hey, if you guys don't do it, we're going to go ahead and have the plaintiffs in this case draw it for you. So clearly the Republican supermajority, it is in their best interest to draw these lines. So if these lines are redrawn and if the Democrats can claw back some seats in 2017, then they might be able to break the Republican supermajority. And at that point, Roy Cooper's power as governor goes up manyfold. I was just trying to look at how long they're likely to be in session. So the North Carolina State Constitution says that we need to have a long session and a short session. But it doesn't really say when either one needs to end. And it doesn't even say that the long session needs to be longer than the short session. But if we look at it kind of past as a guide, it looks like we're going to be in session probably until July or August or September. So September 30th is the latest date that they've gone and the earliest that they've adjourned in one of these long sessions looks like it's been about June. And the average is right around mid-August.
Yeah, I remember it was a standoff between the House and Senate over budget details last time. It kept them there a few more months.
Yes, this is a budget year, right? So the reason the long session is supposed to be longer is this is the year that they write the budget essentially from scratch. They can rewrite it in the even years, but in the odd years, they create a whole new budget. And so that's another thing to look out for. Sometime in March, we will probably see Roy Cooper's budget. Sometime in May, we will probably see a legislative budget. And sometime in the months that come after, we'll see a final budget.
Yeah, and oftentimes, you know, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, the governor who draws the first budget, that budget is often disregarded. But like you said, it's symbolic.
Yeah, and that's the, right, there's the old Apodaca line that I will probably butcher, but that he would always say that, you know, the governor's budget is very valuable as a doorstop. And I think it's going to be Roy Cooper's challenge to sort of fight that perception and make a case that by going first in the negotiation, that he's able to get some of his policy agendas on the table.
What have you heard as far as Apodaca? Is he a lobbyist now? And what kind of influence do you think he might have behind the scenes?
Yeah, he is. He's a lobbyist. He stopped his term early so he could be 6 months out of the General Assembly session so he could start officially lobbying when the General Assembly gavels in. So he will be a lobbyist, and I think he will have an incredible amount of influence. Tom Apodaca knows the players in Raleigh. He knows how things are done in Raleigh. And just because he doesn't have the formal legislative power does not mean that he does not have an incredible amount of informal power. Oftentimes, lobbyists will even write bills and hand them to legislators, and they may not be introduced verbatim, but the very ideas are important. So I think even though Apodaca is not an elected official from Western North Carolina, I think it would be folly to suggest that he's not a powerful figure in Raleigh.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the Asheville City Council today might look at districts, actually.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. So his influence is extended, you know, onto the city council. Despite his bill failing, it certainly had an impact.
Well, and I think that shows us a lot about how politics is practiced, right? The big challenge of politics is attention and information. If you can get people focused on your issues, even if you don't get them passed the first time, you have a very good chance of getting them passed in the long run. And I think Tom Apodaca understands that. And I think he is a political force before, and he's going to be a political force going forward.